We have a very interesting opportunity today to talk with a man who really made the golden age of radio golden, and a man who wrote a book about that golden age and the activities of the first man. Well, who are all these men we're talking about? First of all, I'd like to welcome Richard Crabb, author of a great book, Radio's Beautiful Day, an account of the first five decades of broadcasting in America. Welcome, Richard. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you.
Now, Everett Mitchell is the subject of your book. What made you decide to write a book about Everett Mitchell?
Well, we thought about it for a number of years, but after, let's say we got to 1975 and 76, it became evident that Everett was the last person who was a superstar in the radio era that was able to tell exactly how it was. And so that's really the driving force that resulted in the book.
And how long did it take you to write this book?
Well, it took quite a while, but it's I've done books before, but I've never done a book about a living subject. And that's been very rewarding. We've had, Everett has had more than 500 letters now from readers, and not one of them have pointed out a mistake in the book, and that pleases us a great deal.
Well, and of course, there was no mistake writing the book. I really enjoyed reading about it, and I think what you did by setting the scene of the Chicago area back at the time of Everett Mitchell's childhood.
Right.
It really put things in perspective. You talk about the west side of Chicago, and you talk about his growing up and his parents and all of that sort of thing. I think you really did a nice job of setting that scene.
And how
for
a grocery store was run at that time.
That's correct. That's correct. It's great. Well, why don't you introduce the man you've brought with us?
Well, it's I don't often get an opportunity to introduce Everett now, but I welcome that opportunity. I'd like to say this. Everett, we had broadcast as a scheduled situation began in November of 1920. November is an awfully important month in the background of radio and broadcasting. So many things happened in November. November of 1920, KDKA came on the air and has been on the air continuously since that time. A year later, the first radio station, again in November, opened in Chicago. That'd be 1921. And again in November in 1923, Everett Mitchell had his first broadcast. And so he had a major career before there were networks. He was manager of station WNR. And then when networks came, why, he really blossomed into a national figure. So, Everett, with that introduction, would you tell us about your first broadcast?
Well, Richard, it was on a dare. And, you know, in those days, usually most of the entertainment came from young folks gathering at somebody's house on a Friday or Saturday night and gathering around the piano and singing and playing and enjoying themselves. Well, I had just returned from a concert tour, and I was with some young people. And we got into the evening singing and playing, and then all of a sudden these young people said to me, "Have you heard about this new thing called radio?" And I said, "Yes." I said, "I have a crystal set which I made out of an oatmeal box." And I said, "I'm using the bedspring for an aerial because the landlord says that I can't put up any aerials." So they said, "Well, did you ever think of going down and trying to sing for them?" And I said, "No, I hadn't." "Well," they said, "we dare you." So that was it. I took the dare, went down the next night, which was Saturday, down to KYW. And at that time, it was in the old auditorium building, or auditorium theater. And I went there, and I was surprised because there were quite a few people, but the station was closed. So I heard then that the folks had gone out to dinner. You see, there wasn't any schedules at that time. Whenever they had talent, why, they'd broadcast a show. And talent used to come in or didn't come in, and then the announcer usually played the piano to fill in while they were waiting.
So the announcer was very talented, versatile man then. He would announce, he would play the piano, and do anything he had to fill that time, correct?
I would mention that that KYW was the first station in Chicago.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And you were mentioning about the manager is very profound because he was also manager of the station in addition to being pianist.
Did the whole business.
Did the whole business. Go ahead, Everett.
Herbie came along, and he recognized me because I'd met him. Before I went to the studio, and he said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I thought I'd come up and see if I could sing a song for you." And he said, "Well, okay." So instead of making me wait in line, why, he took me and took me into the studio, and I sang "The Sunshine of Your Smile." And the switchboard lit up, and there were all kinds of calls, so he said, "I'm busy now, but come and see me next week." So next week I came, and I got a regular schedule on KYW, and that's how I started.
Now, how old were you at that time?
How long? I was about a year and a half before I got the job at WENR. And how that happened was Mrs. Mitchell said on Christmas Eve, "I don't think there would be any talent up at WENR on Christmas Eve."
Mm-hmm.
And that was within walking distance of my home. That was on Belmont Avenue in the All-American Radio Building. Well, I went over. There wasn't any talent except Frank Westfall and his orchestra were playing. And then I met Frank Westfall. I said, "I'd like to sing a song for you." So he said, "Okay," put me on, and I sang the Prisoner's Song.
On Christmas Eve? On Christmas Eve, you sang the Prisoner's Song?
Uh-huh. Yes. It was very popular those days.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Well, fortunately,
why don't you remember how the lyrics went?
"Oh, if I had the wings of an angel, over this prison walls I would fly. And I'd fly to the arms of my dear darling, and there I'd be willing to die." So E.N. Rollin, who owned the station and also the All-American Radio Corporation, was listening at home. And he called after I sang his song, and he said, "Boy," he said, "that was wonderful." He said, "How'd you like to sing for me? I'll come and see you Monday. You come Monday." So I came Monday. Well, wasn't long before I was singing for him. Then it wasn't long before I was announcing for him. And within 6 months, I was a station manager.
Boy, that was an overnight success just about, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
You certainly were.
Well, Everett had another job, of course, at the beginning of that. And in the course of that, he left that other job. Tell about leaving the insurance business, Everett.
Well, you see, I had a boss who was a little bit unhappy with radio, and a little bit unhappy with me because he'd heard me at 2 o'clock in the morning and signing off the station. And he called me in and said, "Now, this business of fooling around with this radio," he said, that's something you shouldn't do." He said, "because it's only a fad, and it'll never last." And then he said, "Now, if you continue and you want to continue fooling around with it," why, he said, "you don't have a job here." And then he said, "Oh," he said, "anyway, anybody who's silly enough to accept a fad like that, he might just well go you'll be back in 6 months," he said, "on your knees, looking for a job, but you won't get it."
And you weren't back, though. You never got.
No,
you never went back.
Never went back.
Instead, in 6 months, he was manager of the station.
Yeah. Everett Mitchell is our guest today, and so is Richard Crabb, the author and the subject of a book about Everett Mitchell, Radio's Beautiful Day. We're going to continue with this conversation about those great days, and we're going to find out all about WENR in Chicago in those early days in just a minute. We're talking with Everett Mitchell, the longtime host of the National Farm and Home Hour, and a man who was very instrumental in the development of WENR as a mighty force in Chicago radio, and his biographer, Mr. Richard Crabb. And they're here to talk not only about their career, the Everett's career, but the new book, Radio's Beautiful Day. Everett Mitchell, you started as a singer for Billy Sunday. Didn't you sing with the great evangelist Billy Sunday when you were just a teenager?
Well, you see, fortunately, my voice changed when I was 12 years of age. And I had been singing with some other evangelists and singing the invitation song. Those days, no radio, no amplification, and you had to belt it out if you were going to hear it. Well, a man by the name of Zoller, who was an evangelist, introduced me to Gypsy Smith. And then Gypsy Smith and Zoller introduced me to Billy Sunday. Because, you see, I had been singing at the Pacific Garden Mission as a boy. Well, when Billy Sunday looked at me, he said, can you sing unaccompanied? And I said, yes. He said, well, he said, you see, you would sing the invitation song, and I would mention the name of the song to you, and then you'd have to break into to singing. So I told him I could, and I sang then all of the old-time hymns at his suggestion. One thing he wanted to do when he met me, he said, now, after he decided that he was going to have me sing for him and sing on his programs, he decided then to keep me in knickers so that it would show my real age. Because, you see, I was only 14 years of age.
And people didn't believe that you were that young because your voice had changed.
That's right. That's right.
One of the things that, Chuck, that was a surprise to me and that Everett explained to me, and I believe we do have it in the book, is that Billy Sunday would have different meetings for particular kinds of persons. In other words, the Loop Stores, on one occasion when the big when the big revival occurred here in Chicago, he would have a special service just for the employees at the Loop Store. And they did that in the daytime, and so they let them out during that
time. They closed the store down, maybe.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then he did another one for just railroad men and their families. And he would change the songs of invitation for each of those groups. And one of the things that Everett did was to sing the special song of invitation to the railroad man. I don't ask you to sing that, Everett, but do you remember some of the lyrics that...
Yes. That was titled, Life is Like a Mountain Railroad. And the verse is, life is like a mountain railroad with an engineer this brave, with his hand upon the throttle from the cradle to the grave. He must watch the bridge and trestles, never falter, never fail. With his hand upon the throttle and his eye upon the rail.
Excellent.
Now, a song of invitation was the song inviting the members of the congregation to come forward and
accept,
express their feelings, their faith in the Lord, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I see. Correct.
Now, Everett Mitchell, you started working at WENR, which was owned by E.N. Rollin, hence the call letters, E.N.R. They also made, didn't they make tubes for Zenith radios and things in their own radio thing?
Right.
Mr. Rollin heard you sing on that Christmas Eve in 1924.
Right.
You were just 26 years old at the time, and you he called you in and said, I like what you're doing, and I want you to become the manager of our station, because the manager who was there was going to be let go. Is that correct?
That's right. You see, the manager of the station liked to when he went out to dinner. And usually when he came back, he'd had too much.
Uh-huh.
That's the best way to explain it. Yeah.
And so when you came in there, now, of course, Mr. Rawlin had known from your being with the station for a little bit, known a little bit about you, and you had talked over some things with him. I'm kind of paraphrasing some material from Richard's book here. Mm-hmm. He knew that you had some ideas about broadcasting, and he kind of liked those ideas. So can you tell me, what was WENR like before you took over? What was the kind of programming on the station?
Well, it was one of those little one-room places in the factory, and there was no regular schedule, and there was no talent scheduled. There was no paid talent.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately, when I took over, I decided that I would rearrange the schedule and set it, the broadcasts, at a certain time of the day and a certain time of the evening. And I also would book the talent so the talent would know when to come to the program. Because, you see, in those days they operated on it so that when the door opened and somebody stuck their head in, why, you brought them in if they could whistle, play the harmonica, speak a piece, or sing a song. So we changed that. And in changing it, I had many of radio's firsts. And we made quite a lot of progress. Now, there wasn't any commercialism in those days, but I found out that by putting some of the radios in the studio that I moved to from Belmont Avenue, mm-hmm, in Kimball Hall, people looked at them, and then when I mentioned them, well, sales went up. One of the first things that I did on the Christmas was to install a program where the children would write to me for Santa Claus letters. Then, after I would read these Santa Claus letters, a little elf would come down from the North Pole from Santa Claus, and his name, by the way, was Peter. And Peter would say a few words, and then he'd gather the letters, and then the children would hear him going up the chimney and going up, mm-hmm, back to the North Pole of the letters. One of the things that came out of it, though, was the fact that I had many, many requests for shoes. So I went to the Salvation Army and to some of the newspapers, especially when they had the journal at that time, Daily Journal. And I went to them and asked them to help out. And we did. We sent many, many pair of shoes to the children, mm-hmm, that year. Mm-hmm. Then the next year, the journal asked me to put a program on Christmas, getting shoes for children. So, but the Santa Claus program, now to lead up to commercialism, I found out that they had a tree lighter that was sold by All American Radio, and it was one that illuminated the tree and also had a place for the water so that you could keep the tree fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mentioned the fact that they had that. I didn't do any sales job on it, but just mentioned it, and they sold it out.
Uh-huh.
In fact, there was so much traffic in these places coming in to look, and they bought the tree lighter out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the thing that led up to the commercialism. So then I decided that there was room for commercialism. And I sold one of the first commercial programs in Chicago, which was called the Bambi Bread Makers. And it was by the Piper Baking Company, uh-huh, at that, mm-hmm, time.
I think, Everett, it wasn't one of the first. It was the first.
Well,
the first commercial
in
Chicago?
I don't want to lay any claim to it, but if it was, it was wonderful. And but I know it was one of the first, anyhow. So then that was the first commercial that was written, and I wrote the first commercial.
Well, did you, it wasn't a singing commercial. You've done so much singing, it wasn't a singing commercial.
It's a different story today.
Well, now, WENR was over a period of years, it moved from one studio to another, each time getting a little bit more elaborate, didn't it?
Right. Well, you see, Herbstein.
Now, we're talking about Charles Herbstein, right?
Yes, he was Willie, Tommy, Annie, and Sammy, WTAS. And he had this studio at in room 712 of the Kimball Building. But he decided he was going to go out to Elgin. So that studio was open. And I made a deal and got that studio. Then he decided in 6 months that he wanted to come back again.
Mm-hmm.
So he came in and...
And you were out.
Huh? I didn't have any lease on the studio. So I went over to the Strauss Building, which had had a radio station. And they had what we called a... Spanish Garden, and it was beautiful, and it was only the only studio that had an organ in it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also a place for the people to come and sit. And so I got this place in the Strauss Building, and we were in the Strauss Building until Insel bought us and took us over into the Opera Building. So...
Now, you're talking about Samuel Insel. This is the big man in the utilities, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
What's that?
He's the utility man, the big man, the magnate, as they would say.
He paid $1.5 million for that station. Then WBCN, which was sharing time with WNR, they wanted him to buy WBCN. And... he said, I'll soon be buying up all of it. Then you remember, Insel got in trouble. He was innocent. I knew him. He called me son. I was his personal announcer. We were very close. He was not guilty of the things that they said he was guilty of. So he had to sell the station, and NBC bought it.
Mm-hmm.
But Mr. Insel... put me in his furniture and fixtures, and so I went over to NBC.
Oh, so that is when WENR became part of NBC then.
Yes, that's right.
Now, you said you were Samuel Insel's personal announcer.
Yes.
Now, why did he need a personal announcer?
Because he was a very particular man who was very time conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And to let you know how I used to have my conferences with him, he would make a date for 1 o'clock for me. Now, at 1:50, I had to be in the outer office. At 1:01, I had to be at the inside office.
Mm-hmm.
At 1 o'clock, I had to be standing before Mr. Insel's desk when he carried on his conversation with him. So, he used to have his stockholder meetings in the Commonwealth Edison Building. And he would leave his office, and then when he got on the elevator, they would give me the signal. I had to start to introduce him, and as he got to the microphone, I had to say, Mr. Insel, and step aside. Now, that's how time comes.
I see. And you, that's how you became his personal announcer, too. You did... You introduced him.
I think it's a special interest to note that NBC was just in the process of coming to Chicago. Mm-hmm. There were no networks prior to that time. And they decided to acquire two stations, and they acquired WNR. Everett doesn't speak of those things, but it's obvious since he became Insel's personal announcer, it's obvious that he was one of the considerations in doing it, because... there were radio stations that Insel could have had for just paying their bills, and he wouldn't have had to pay $1.5 million for it. And then he also bought WMAQ, and he had a relationship with WLS because WLS and WNR were competing for free for an open channel on that. And then, of course, WNR had that other very great asset They had that beautiful studio at the top of the Civic Opera Building, mm-hmm. four mm-hmm. stories of it. So this really was NBC's entrance into Chicago.
Yeah, and that's what I'd like to talk with you about, Richard, too, because I think you have some, you've done a great deal of research in your book, Radio's Beautiful Day, about the early days of NBC here and how that all came about. I'd like to talk with you after we take a short break. We're talking with Richard Crabb, author of Radio's Beautiful Day, and the subject of that book, Everett Mitchell, who later on is going to tell us what kind of a day it is in Chicago.
Right.
We're talking about the early days of broadcasting in Chicago with Everett Mitchell, the longtime host of the National Farm and Home Hour, and a man who I think literally put WENR on the air, or on the map, I should say. And his biographer, the author of Radio's Beautiful Day, good book, published by North Plains Press, that's Richard Crabb. Richard, you were talking before we took a short break about the coming of NBC to Chicago and how Samuel Insull had bought the two stations, or he had WENR, and then NBC came to town to buy the two stations.
Right.
Now, what was NBC's entry into the Chicago market?
Well, NBC, of course, began in the East, mm-hmm. because that's where broadcasting began. When NBC was formed, it began acquiring some outstanding stations. One of the first it acquired was KDKA in Pittsburgh, and they even originated the National Farm and Home Hour mm-hmm. before they came to Chicago, before there was any network in Chicago. And then they knew all the time that they were going to come, that Chicago was going to become their main hub.
Mm-hmm.
And they even had representatives that visited Everett while he was program manager for Insull's station at WNR and that sort of thing. And they came to Chicago in 1929, and they were looking for enough rental space that they could base their operations here, and they weren't able to get enough space in one location. Now, the Merchandise Mart was being built by the Field Estate at that mm-hmm. time, and was to be a 19-story building, and the steel was up to 19 stories, and NBC entered into a historic agreement by which the Field Estate added two more stories to the Merchandise Mart, and leased the entire two stories to NBC for 50 years.
For 50 years. And I think that lease is running out now, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's just recently run out.
Mm-hmm.
So it shows how long it really was.
You don't think much about 50 years when you're signing a lease like that, but then all of a sudden, and as I understand that NBC is thinking of withdrawing its studios from the Merchandise Mart.
That's logical, because when they came here, and during most of those years, the mechanical facility of the network, every program, whether it was originated in New York or Los Angeles or wherever, was fed in directly into Chicago and then sent to the places where it was going to mm-hmm. be broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're not doing that anymore. Now, the whole matter has changed, and
yes.
so they don't
mm-hmm.
need that great hub effect that they did, mm-hmm. and I'm sure they will find, they'll arrange to be in smaller space.
Everett Mitchell, you came to work for NBC then when the National Broadcasting Company bought WENR. That was the Blue Network then. The ENR became the Blue Network, is that right?
Yes.
And WMAQ, which was the daily news mm-hmm. station up before that time,
right.
was the Red Network
right.
of the National Broadcasting
Company. And the
National
Farm and Home Hour was carried on both.
It was carried on both networks?
Right.
All stations.
Simultaneously?
Yes. Yes.
I see. Now,
it was unique in that respect.
I would say it would be, because in some cities, and I suppose most cities in the country wouldn't have both a red and a blue station, right?
Well, some did, but mm-hmm. They made the arrangement. We haven't mentioned the fact that the National Farm and Home Hour, from the time it originated in Chicago until 1944, was a sustaining program. It's the
no commercials.
Largest sustaining broadcasting effort in the history of broadcasting.
Mm.
And so when NBC was making it available and having the United States Department of Agriculture as a partner, mm-hmm. the only time that the department has ever done that, mm-hmm. why, they naturally put it out everywhere, and so they used it on both networks.
Now, before Everett Mitchell came on the air with the National Farm and Home Hour, Richard, who was hosting the show, and what was the format of the show?
I'm glad you mentioned that. That's a very interesting story. They had brought an announcer from New York. Now, bear in mind that radio was new, and so you didn't hire. There was not any opportunity to hire a person mm-hmm. who had 5 years' experience or 10 years' experience doing this or that. And this gentleman that they brought from New York, I'm sure was their crack announcer, had been a shoe salesman, and his voice and that sort of thing was very good, but one of his major responsibilities when he came to Chicago was to be a moderator of the National Farm and Home Hour. He knew nothing about agriculture, and he got mm-hmm. into some difficulty, must have Everett explain this to you, but Everett, when he got into difficulty, NBC went to all of their 25 announcers in Chicago and asked them if they knew the difference between a haystack and a straw stack, and Everett was the only person who did.
And that was a total qualification for being a...
Well, it was the trigger.
The trigger.
It was the trigger. Everett, tell about the fact that you were asked about a haystack and a straw stack.
Well, I'll tell you what I'd like to do, Richard. I'd like to tell you what led up to it. You see, we had a corn husking contest, and this announcer went out with a derby hat on and overcoat with a velvet collar and spats. And
this fellow, you mean the one who was the
New York, right?
The New Yorker who was hosting the Farm and Home Hour
from New York. Right. So he kept calling the haystacks straw stacks, and
the farmers
were listening, and they were absolutely, well, they were intense. They were mad because they didn't think NBC should have a man on there that didn't know the difference between a straw stack and a haystack. So there were many, many letters came, and so then NBC decided to do something about it. And you told them, Richard, that among the announcers, I was the only one who knew the difference. Well, the reason I happened to know the difference was because I was born on a little farm on the prairie in Moreland, Illinois, which is now part of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was brought up with a straw stack and a haystack. So...
Everett, there may be some folks yet that don't quite know that.
Yes, and my hand is up, too. I don't know the difference. But see, I could never get that job. You were safe.
you would have a straw stack if you threshed the wheat. Mm-hmm. Then the straw from the wheat, it goes into a straw stack. However, there are many kinds of different things like clover, alfalfa, and the many grasses that are grown mm-hmm. for hay. And they cut those, and those go into a haystack.
Nice.
So the hay is really a grass. The straw comes from threshed grain.
I see.
And there were a lot of people didn't know. But anyhow, when Frank Mullen, who was director of agriculture, asked me about it, I told him yes, I knew it. He told me to tell him, so I told him. Then he said, "Well, I'll take you out in the country, and you identify the various crops." And I did. And when I came back, he said, "Well, Everett," he said, "you're going to be on the Farm and Home Hour." And that was one of the most wonderful things that ever happened to me in all my life.
Now, when was that?
That was in
1930.
And then in 1932, when I coined the phrase, "It's a beautiful day in Chicago," that's when life turned.
Mm-hmm.
Because coining that phrase led to travel in 67 countries of the world and in the interest of agriculture. And every one of those countries wanted me to say it was a beautiful day in their country,
uh-huh.
even in Russia. So when I was making some tapes in Moscow, I said it was a beautiful day in Moscow. But I had one client on the Farm and Home Hour whose business I brought in, and I was with that one client, Alice Chalmers, for 18 years. But 38 years on the Farm and Home Hour. In the beginning, all of the NBC stations, 16 million people a day. So it was quite an audience.
A real run on radio. You say 1930 is when you started, and 38 years you were on the air with the National Farm and Home Hour until 1968. That's not too shabby a run. They must have liked what you were doing. Now, it was a five or six days a week for a while, wasn't it?
It was 6 days a week.
6 days a week in the beginning.
Until 1944.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then the government insisted that NBC dispose of one of those two networks.
Mm-hmm.
And they elected to sell the Blue Network. And it has now, of course, become the American Broadcasting Company. And in order to make the deal more appealing, they included the National Farm and Home Hour. Now that sounds kind of strange that they they would include a farm program, mm-hmm. but America was largely a nation of farmers at that time. And its rating was even ahead of Fibber, McGee, and Molly at that particular time. So it was an asset when it came to selling that Blue Network.
And then was it after the sale?
After the sale,
when
then
the Alice Chalmers
made the transition over. And Everett had an understanding when that sale was made that if for any reason in the future the Blue Network didn't continue the National Farm and Home Hour in its accustomed manner, that he might come back to NBC and the old Red Network. And he elected to do that. And so in 1945, this remarkable sponsorship with Alice Chalmers began as a feature program every Saturday noon. And I was much interested in your telling about the fact that as a youngster, you went down to NBC on Saturday mornings and actually attended those programs.
Right. Before the tape started rolling, I mentioned to these both of these gentlemen that I had spent many a Saturday at noontime on the, I guess it was the 18th or 19th floor of the Merchandise Mart, and I saw Everett Mitchell and Whitey Berquist in the orchestra and all these other people in a... I really wanted to see a radio broadcast, and this was a radio broadcast. I must confess that at the time, I didn't realize how important a radio broadcast this was, that it had been such a long-running show and what a major impact it had on broadcasting in general and on the agricultural community in specific. And I believe that there were a lot of people, and I've learned since, and have collected a number of National Farm and Home Hour programs and things like that, I've learned since that your audience was much, much greater than strictly a farm audience.
Yes.
People coming in out of the fields at noontime on Saturday, for example, or daily to have their midday meal and listen to this program. But there were many people in the urban centers of the United States who listened to this program and got a lot of good information.
In fact, the audience was about 50-50.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, that was designed as the farm and home program because homes are everywhere and that sort of thing.
Everett Mitchell, how did you? What made you say it's a wonderful or it's a beautiful day in Chicago? Where did that come from?
It was a very dramatic story because I was coming down as usual with a group of four men on the Northwestern Railroad, and it was on a Saturday morning. And by the way, it was the morning after they had found Lindbergh's baby's body.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And these men were in the depths of depression. One of them said, as far as this country's concerned, it's through. It never, ever can survive. He said, you know, he said, God's forgotten us. And I said, God hasn't forgotten us. We've forgotten God. I said, we're worshiping the almighty dollar. Well, that night, he went home and killed himself. However, I felt at that time that really somebody must say some word of encouragement because there were so many discouraged people in the world. Well, I stepped outside of the Chicago Northwestern Station. It had been raining a little bit. And then I looked up at the sky, and there's an old story that says, if there's enough blue in the sky to patch a Dutchman's pants, it's going to be a beautiful day. Well, I thought, there's that blue, and it's going to be a beautiful day. Then there was a little poem that I used to know, which said, if any little word of mine will set a heart to singing, if any little word of mine will set a bell to ringing, God help me say that word and set that heart to singing and set that bell to ringing. And as I walked over, the beautiful day began to come into my mind, and I thought, well, it sure is a great day to be alive, and after all, I think I'll say it's a beautiful day when I open the program. Didn't get there in time to clear it, but when I stood there before the microphone, I said, it's a beautiful day in Chicago. Oh, it's been raining a little bit outside. Temperature's in the 60s. But it's a great day to be alive, and I hope it's even more beautiful wherever you are. Well, the orchestra reached for where hair used to be, and the engineer didn't know whether I'd gone berserk or not, and whether he should turn it off. But then I started right in and said, the National Farm and Home Hour, and continued the program. Mm-hmm. After the program, the president and vice president in charge of You Can't Do That sent for me, because he wanted to know why I said it. Well, before I could answer his question, page boy came and said the switchboard's tied up. And there are all kinds of long-distance calls. May Everett come and take some of the calls. So I took one of the calls, and it was a man from Boston who said, in the name of God, how can you be so cheerful in times like this? But he said, please say it again, because it made me feel good. Well, the next day we got 13,000 letters.
Oh, my goodness.
All asking to say it's a beautiful day. And that saying, by the way, is 52 years old this May 14th.
Uh-huh.
And it's lasted all of these years. Even today when I'm introduced to somebody, they say, oh, radio's beautiful day.
Mm-hmm.
And that, as I said before, led to the travel into all of these countries, and it also led to me being a war correspondent on a food mission in Korea. So it has lived all of these years.
Well, it certainly was and is an inspirational way to say hello to a listening audience. And I think from those depression days when people were feeling down, I think you hit the absolute perfect note for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. And the inspiration came, though maybe from a sad experience with those people you met on the train and the one man who died. But an awful lot of good came from that. And a lot of good came from your work on radio, Everett Mitchell. I know that over the years, all the energies that you have had and the talents, you really went with a single thing in mind. You wanted to do a good job, and I think you did a good job. You agree, don't you, Richard?
Yes, and I have always thought that the most magical part of Everett's saying was, and I hope it's even more beautiful wherever you are.
Yes, yes.
That's really the magic.
That's for sure. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the National Farm and Home Hour, and I also want to bounce back a little bit in time and talk about some of the programs that you developed over on WENR. So we'll continue in just a break with Richard Crabb, author of Radio's Beautiful Day, which is an account of the first five decades of broadcasting in America based on the experiences of our other guest, Mr. Everett Mitchell. Well, it is a beautiful day in Chicago, and we're talking with Everett Mitchell, the man who created that very well-known phrase. It stands right along with Don't Touch That Dial and the old clock up on the studio wall and so many other familiar sayings from the radio days. Everett Mitchell is here, as is Richard Crabb, the author of Radio's Beautiful Day, a good look at the history of radio and the role that Everett Mitchell played in it. Everett Mitchell, when you became the manager of WENR back in the 1920s, you said earlier in our conversation that you started actually programming the material that was on the air, no longer a hit-and-miss basis where if a singer or a storyteller was out in the hall and said, grab him by the neck and come in and stick him in front of the microphone. Now you said Tuesday at 4 o'clock this is going to be on, and Wednesday night at 7 we're going to have this kind of a program and that sort of a thing. You were responsible for many innovations and many firsts in the radio days. Did you have something to do with a program called The Smith Family?
Yes, I did. In fact, I was one of the original members of The Smith Family.
You were?
Yes. Uh-huh. And it was a very successful program. Now, one of the first things I did at WENR was to give some classical music.
Mm-hmm.
They had all jazz when I went to it, but I made many of the papers with the announcement that I would have this concert at 6 o'clock in the evening, from 6 until 7 in the evening. And that was the first program of classical music. Mm-hmm. Most of it was all popular music. And that became very, very popular.
And this, of course, was live music. It was not
recorded
music.
It was live. Uh-huh. And it was really very, very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got a lot of publicity on it. Now, there were many changes then that I made so that when people tuned in, they knew what they were going to hear. And the program then got some publicity, and the mm-hmm. people knew mm-hmm. what was on. Now, one of the things that I wanted to do when I went into radio was to build up and not to tear down.
Mm-hmm.
And one
mm-hmm.
of the things that I saw the opportunity in was to bring people closer together. And so one of the original programs that I broadcast was called the Smile Club. And we had a rather interesting thing happen to the Smile Club, because we used to go out to the veterans, and then we'd pick out the veteran from a hospital and mention that veteran on the air. Well, the Smile Club was a very, very happy program with a lot of laughter
mm-hmm.
because it was for the shut-ins. Well, we were at the height of the Smile Club and having an awful good time when the door opened of the studio and Mr. Insull walked in. And uh-huh. everybody became silent.
They stopped smiling.
Because they knew how stern he was. So he said to me, "What happened?" Well, I said, "I guess maybe they thought that they shouldn't be having all of this fun do all of this happy broadcasting because maybe you wouldn't like it." He said, "Tell them to go ahead." So mm-hmm. they did, and he left the studio. But he was really surprised. Then there was another one I'd like to tell you about. Nobody had ever had a program where they told about the different states of the Union and what those states were famous for,
mm-hmm.
what their main objects were, what they, what kind of institutions they had. And so I founded a program called Know and Boost Your Own United States. And the governors would send me a telegram, and I would get the information from their chambers of commerce, and then I had an hour program. A little later on, Middle West Utilities sponsored it.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a vice president of Middle West Utilities who wanted to be in the radio. So he decided if I would write it, then he'd like to announce it.
Uh-huh.
Well, he did. But that, of course, went with the selling of the station.
Chuck, it always fascinates me that Everett's great contributions really stemmed from that initial thrust of scheduling. That everything flowed from it. Now, he mentioned the dinner program. They didn't have that. They didn't even broadcast during the time, the supper or
the dinner hour
period,
yes, uh-huh,
at the beginning. And when he started, they observed, but he did schedule it. He said, no, we'll do this from 6 to 8, so you could at least depend on when the station wasn't going to be on there. And then it occurred to him, well, my, this is an opportunity to give people dinner music right in their homes. And so, you see, that became a first. And in addition to all of the other things that he has mentioned, he tried to fit the programming during the entire day to the audience that was then listening. In the afternoon, and they started at 2 o'clock. He had mostly homemakers, and so they'd have homemakers. And then he had his first farm program at 5 o'clock, and then he had a children's program, and his children program turned out to be quite a success. It continued for 15 or 16 years.
Was that the Air Juniors?
That was the
Air Juniors. What was Everett? What was the idea behind the program, the Air Juniors?
Well, in the original idea of the children's program, it was called the Air Scouts.
Uh-huh.
But then the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts got unhappy, so we had to change it. And it was with Irma Glenn, and it was an educational program, one of the first on the air. And then it was also one of the first radio children's program that ended with a prayer. And it became famous within the first 6 months that we had the program on the air. We had 50,000 members, and it was a very, very wonderful.
And this was just a local program. This was not on the network,
yes,
was it?
Local program.
50,000
kids. On WNR.
Yeah.
Yes.
But those members that Everett speaks about came from 20 states, so you can see WNR...
had a powerful signal.
Had a good signal.
Yes, uh-huh.
See, there was one uncanny thing about WNR. It reached out to many, many points of the world. In fact, I received... quite an honor from New Zealand. I was declared the most popular overseas announcer in New Zealand. And then when I went to New Zealand, I met some of the people that had been in the business of giving me the award.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite a pleasure.
Oh, I would say
yes.
So. Now, I have... Over the years, I've done a lot of listening and searching and digging about radio and the radio days. And, of course, your name, Everett Mitchell, always turns up. But when you talk about WENR, it seems to me that today, after all of these years, the one program that people remember about WENR are the WENR Minstrels, the Wiener Minstrels. Now, you had something to do with
yes.
that, didn't you?
And then do you remember the horse race they had on at 10 o'clock in the evening?
Now, I don't remember it, but I guess it was there.
there was a horse race which was controlled by dealing cards. And I would call this horse race as the rider's car came up. Well, it became so popular that Amos and Andy, who were on at 10 o'clock, they objected. They didn't want the horse race to be on because it took away from their WGN audience. Well, anyway, what happened was the group who practiced fixing races came to me and wanted me to fix the race. and I could have had all kinds of money, and it would have been very simple to fix it.
Mm.
But I didn't yield to temptation, and the race wasn't fixed. But when Commonwealth Edison Company, who owned the station at that time, when they found out that they wanted to fix the race, then they had the race removed
and they took them off
from the air.
Yeah. What were I want to get back to the Wiener Minstrels. What was that show? The Wiener Minstrels. What kind of a show was it? Was it a minstrel show?
The Wiener Minstrel.
That was really, really quite something. Gene Arnold and his cadets quartet and Chuck and Ray, they were on that that program. And Gene, by the way, made the minstrel show so popular that it was sold to Sinclair, and it was on as a sponsored program for quite some time. And it was too bad that the minstrel went off, because it was very popular. Now, one of the things that never should have happened was they shouldn't have let the people see the sound effects and how they were made. Uh-huh. Because, you see, they would take a little wooden block and take the drummer's sticks,
mm-hmm.
and as they were supposed to go into the tap dance, they'd make the tap dance on
they'd
the wooden
tap on
block.
The blocks, huh?
And so many people were wondering how, he must be a wonderful dancer, and they come in and see the wooden block.
But only a few people really got in to see
no.
the show, right? There weren't that many who saw it.
Yeah.
Well, see, that's part of the magic of radio.
Yeah.
It's the
Bill Child was one of what that was supposed to do the tap dance.
Well, Everett Mitchell, you've had really a wonderful career, and you've spent so many years of your life devoted to radio and establishing so many first for radios. And a real important part of it all was, of course, your dedication to having radio be much more than music or entertainment. You've done an awful lot in the area of public service, which was really your whole life with the National Farm and Home Hour for many years as a sustaining program on both the Red and the Blue networks, and then as a sponsored program for Alice Chalmers. Now, a city boy, I never even knew who Alice Chalmers was, but I learned of them, the tractors and the other farm implement equipment, from listening to the National Farm and Home Hour.
Well, it was the greatest privilege in the world to work with rural people.
Mm-hmm.
And I say it was a God-given privilege. Thank
you. Well, we're happy that you did all of that, and we're glad that you came by today.
Thank you.
And Richard Crabb, I've read your book. It's a wonderful book. It's available at bookstores all around, and I might add at our Metro Golden Memory Shop. It's called Radio's Beautiful Day, and everything we've talked about today and so much more is detailed in a very fine style. I really like your style. You put everything in perspective. You say, while Everett Mitchell was doing this, the country was doing that, the situation was here and there. And milestones in radio, I think you mentioned David Sarnoff clicking on his doing Morse code from the Titanic, right. and all of that sort of, the telegraph, I'll get the word eventually. It's a great book, and I certainly recommend it, and I'm delighted to have had both of you join us in our studio today. Everett Mitchell, will you tell us what kind of a day it is, just one more time before we go?
It's a beautiful day.
Oh, I would like to say, it's a beautiful day in Chicago. Well, of course, it's a little on the cool side, temperature is 63, but it's a great day to be alive, and I hope it's even more beautiful wherever you are. Thank you.
Thank you.